Two of the guests we have on today both have a certain different perspectives. They're different generationally and areas of focus. And for the first half of the hour, we're going to have author and lecturer and Civil War expert William Connery. And for the second half of the show, we're going to have Matthew Ang. He's a Deputy Director of Education for the Hampton Roads Museum. And we'll go straight to our first guest, Bill. Welcome to MidRats.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hey, if you could, this is obviously a very busy and exciting time for those who have invested so much in this segment of our nation's history. And you, for many years, have been doing a lot of lecturing on the Civil War. What areas do you focus on with regard to the Civil War, and what started you on this subject?
Oh, wow. As a young child, I discovered, you know, everybody knows their birthday, the day they were born. I had the good fortune to be born on January 19th, which used to be a holiday in five southern states. I believe you should know whose birthday that is. Certain southern general by the name of Robert E. Lee. Also, January 19th happens to be the birthday of the poet Edgar Allan Poe. And he was buried in Baltimore, and I was born on his birthday in Baltimore. So I feel like a closeness to Poe and to Robert E. Lee. And as a young teenager, it was the centennial, the early 60s. And I was lucky enough to have my family. We visited Gettysburg and Antietam. Harper's Ferry, still one of my favorite places, and of course, Washington, D.C. So from grammar school, I was interested in history and specifically Civil War, war between the states. I could rattle on for half an hour to the War of Northern Aggression, the War of Southern Independence, whatever name you give it. And now we have the sesquicentennial, which is 150th anniversary, and I'm glad I'm alive to take part in this time.
You go on.
So the main topic that you want me to talk about, what the things I do?
What are the major areas that you lecture in?
Well, I... right now, my major areas, I have a talk on Robert E. Lee, but Robert E. Lee after the war. I think recently on PBS, they had a special on Robert E. Lee, and they spent like 2 minutes on what he did after the war. And the way PBS put it was, well, he lost at Appomattox, and he slunk off to Lexington to become president of this little college because... you know, he had nothing better to do. But
how ignorant.
Yeah. In reality, he was offered a position. He prayed. He asked the help of God and his local ministers, and he felt it was providential for him to be offered that position. And as president of Washington College, which, of course, today is Washington and Lee University, he helped bring the southern states out of the depression of the Civil War, and also he became quite a good fundraiser, but most especially as a exemplar of moral character. So I have that talk. I have a talk on President John Tyler, one of the lesser known of our presidents, but he was the man who tried to stop the Civil War from even starting. He was the president of the Peace Conference here in Washington, D.C. I have other talks on Frederick Douglass, on United States color troops at Fort Pocahontas, and I've just developed my latest talk is on Fort McHenry during the Civil War, the case of habeas corpus and everything that was going down in my hometown, Baltimore, during the Civil War.
When you're going to speak at the Navy location in Washington, what's the topic of your discussion then?
Okay, well, my topic then is going to be the CSS Shenandoah, the last shot of the Civil War, and I don't want to give everything away, but
I've read your article, so.
Okay, you know, basically, I give like a short history of especially the Confederate Navy in England. Even today, the listeners, you can go to when Liverpool was Dixie, .co.uk, which is a website run out of Liverpool. Because the two brothers, James and Irvine Bullock, are buried there. James Bullock was from Georgia. He was in the Merchant Marine. He brought his ship, his merchant ship, back to New York when Georgia left the Union. And his sister was there in New York. And when he bade his goodbyes to her family, there was a little three-year-old boy. And years later, he would tell the story of his Uncle Jimmy coming to visit them before heading south. And that little boy's name, his nickname at that time was Petey. And eventually his nickname changed to Teddy. And we all know him now as Teddy Roosevelt, who was an assistant secretary of the Navy and helped develop the Navy, the Great White Fleet, in the early part of the 20th century. But his first feelings towards the sea and sailing ships and everything going on was through his mother's elder brother. James Bullock eventually wound up in Liverpool. He was the Confederate agent over there. Of course, the most famous ship that he commissioned was the Alabama under Captain Sims, who ravaged the seas for about 2 years, destroyed over 60 Union merchant ships, and was finally destroyed off the coast of France in 1864. Also at that time, James Bullock, he saw that the Confederate Navy couldn't do anything just with wooden ships, that they needed these new ironclad ships. Of course, the first real ironclad ship was the CSS Virginia, usually known as the Merrimack. The Merrimack was the original name, but it was sunk actually by the U.S. Navy and then resurrected and rebuilt as a the ironclad Virginia. And Bullock tried to build ships over in England and France, but the U.S. consuls to those countries were able to stop him. So he figured, well, the only way I can get anything done is to send out another raider. The Alabama has been sunk, so there was a British ship by the name of the Sea King. It was one of the fastest ships. It had made the run from England to Bombay and back in record time. And Bullock was able to buy the ship. The British had what they called the Neutrality Act. They were not supposed to arm any ship or anybody to fight a nation that they were not at war at. At that time, Great Britain was not at war with the United States. So when the Sea King left from England, it was unarmed. And the American, the Yankees were looking at it, and they didn't see any guns on the deck, any armament. So they let it sail out. And then from another port, Bullock had another ship with crates and things. That, and in those crates were the cannons and the Whitworth rifle and all the guns and the crew. And they loaded up the Sea King off of one of the Madeira Islands. They rechristened it the CSS Shenandoah, and it received a captain, and the the captain was Commander James Iredell Waddell, formerly of the U.S. Navy, now of the Confederate States Navy. And from that time, one of the stories I like is when they loaded the supplies on the Shenandoah, and they brought on all the guns and everything, and then they noticed, there's no blocks and tackles here. So if they had to use their big guns to stop a merchant ship, the guns probably would have blown out the other side of the ship because it had no blocks and tackles to keep it tied down. So once they started raiding, they were able to get these supplies from other ships. An interesting thing about the Shenandoah, similar to the Alabama, it was what they called a composite ship. It was a fully rigged ship, and it had a 200 horsepower auxiliary engine. So when there was no wind, they could use the engine. It had a single propeller. When the wind was good, they could winch up the propeller into the hull and then use the sails. And they got enough supplies from the ships they raided to get their coal on board. And also this steam engine was of such a design that it not only produced power for the propeller, it produced water. But it didn't have to stop anywhere to pick up water, so fresh water. All they had to do is rev up the steam power plant and produce power for the propeller and water for the crew. So the ship sailed through the Indian Ocean, and the story was that Captain Waddell would wake up in the night and say, "There's something wrong. I feel something wrong with the ship. Go check the propeller." So the men probably, looked up to heavens, one of these crazy captains. They looked at the propeller. They said, "There's nothing wrong." He went back to bed. He woke up again and said, "Take the innards out and check." And they checked along the fitting that connected the propeller to the engine, and they discovered that fitting had been spliced together. That there was something wrong. That the Waddell was so in tune to the ship, even the rod spinning around inside its casing, he could hear it or sense it. That something is wrong.
Yeah, there's something about the instincts of a ship skipper who has plenty of sea time that it's really hard to second guess. A couple of years ago, to my readers, I recommended John Baldwin and Ron Powers' book on the CSS Shenandoah, Last Flag Down. I thought it was a really good book, even though I had issues with its cover art. What was your opinion of that book? And is there a story about the Shenandoah that, for whatever reason, may have been left out of the book that you think might be an interesting story that somebody who read the book might want to know?
I think I've read every other book beside that. I've got them on my desk here. Actually, the first book I read was The Memoirs of Lieutenant Commanding James Waddell, which was published in about 1960. And then 2005 was the 140th anniversary of the Shenandoah. And then there came out books like The Officers of the CSS Shenandoah, Sea of Gray, The Voyage of the CSS Shenandoah, Confederate Raider. There was a novel written in about 1960 called Seek Out and Destroy, which was like a composite of the adventures of the Alabama and the Shenandoah. And recently a book called The Sea King and The Last Shot. But, many different, well, for example, I was interested in some of the men who served on the Shenandoah. One of the officers was Irvine Bullock, who was a half-brother of James Bullock. Irvine Bullock was the only officer who also served. He had served on the Alabama, and he had also served on the first Confederate raider, the CSS Florida. And both Irvine and James Bullock stayed in England after the war. Their graves are in Liverpool. In 1905, Teddy Roosevelt was the first president to tour the South after Abraham Lincoln 40 years before. And he stopped at the museum, what's now called the Museum of the Confederacy in Richmond, and the curator there showed him his uncle Irvine's sword. One of the other officers was Sidney Smith Lee Jr. And of course he was the son of Sidney Smith Lee Sr. But I guess more important, his uncle was some guy by the name of Robert E. Lee. So Robert E. Lee's nephew was serving as an officer on board the Shenandoah. I think the most amazing thing about this ship is it captured 38 mainly whaling. Its mission was to seek out and destroy Union fleet activities where no raider had gone before, and that was mainly in the Bering Sea. It caught about half of the Union fleet there. The New Bedford whaling fleet sunk about nine ships, put all the men on three ships and bonded them and set them loose. It briefly went through the Bering Straits into the Arctic Ocean. So besides circumnavigating the globe, it went into the Arctic Ocean, and Captain Waddell had a plan to attack San Francisco. He had read in the papers that there was only one Union ship guarding San Francisco, which was named the Saginaw, and Waddell had been the junior officer on board the Saginaw before the war. So he knew the ship. He felt he could sneak into San Francisco, bombard the city, and ransom, you know, all the gold in the port of San Francisco. Luckily for San Francisco, he stopped a British ship. This was already like July of 1865. He stopped a British ship, got on board the newspapers, and he discovered Lee had surrendered, Lincoln had been shot and killed, Jeff Davis had surrendered, and the Union fleet was out on the high seas searching for the pirate ship Shenandoah. So that's why they went all the way around South America, and they landed in Liverpool in November 1865 and hauled down what's considered the last Confederate flag, and that flag is in the Museum of the Confederacy down in Richmond.
When the Shenandoah was doing its commerce raiding, for want of a better phrase,
yeah.
The purpose of that, of going after the whalers, was because what was the importance of the whale oil at that time?
Oh, well, their main purpose was to destroy northern shipping and to destroy the northern economy. And at that time, whale oil was one of the main. They were switching from candle lights and from gas lights to whale oil. Now, I think it was also at that time, the mid 1860s, that I forget who it was, but a chemist somewhere had been able to crack the petroleum, and they were starting to produce this new substance called kerosene. So it was probably because of the Shenandoah that the whale oil fell off, because they had destroyed half of the whaling fleet, and kerosene, its stock rose up. But the main point was to cripple the United States in its especially its merchant and whaling fleet. And until World War II, the United States, most ships, because of first the Alabama and then the Shenandoah, many ships switched their ownership from the United States to England or France or Brazil or some other country, and the United States didn't regain its real merchant ship fleet until World War II.
What? How? The Shenandoah was I think, as you've indicated, was partially steam powered,
yeah,
and also had the option of using the sails. What kind of fuel did they use? And we had later on, you know, we had to develop coaling stations around the world to get our own fleet operational around the world. How did the Shenandoah refuel itself?
From what I've read, it got most of its coal from other ships, even though almost all the ships it, you want to say, attacked were sailing ships. Some of them were carrying coal from one place to another, and they could load up on enough coal that they didn't have to go into port. Probably when they were in Melbourne, they also loaded up there. There's also a Civil War group in Melbourne, Australia. An interesting story is that 10 years after the war, Waddell came back to the United States. He was given a pardon. He was given command of a steamership called the San Francisco that made its maiden voyage from San Francisco to Melbourne. And somehow the people there got wind that the pirate captain Waddell, who had been there 10 years before, was coming back. And he didn't know what kind of reception, but it was reported that when the San Francisco steamed into Melbourne, that there were people lined up on the shore, and they were chanting, you know, Waddell, Waddell. They he had made quite an impression 10 years before, and he's buried up in Annapolis near the Naval Academy. I think it's St. Mary's, and at the end of his life in the early 1880s, he was the captain of the Maryland oyster fleet. There was what was called the Oyster War between small Maryland ships and Virginia. The Virginia ships were raiding into Maryland territory, and he once again was able to blast the ships out of the water. And I guess the final thing is nobody was killed. They fired warning shots, and on the Alabama itself, only two people died of the crew, and that was through natural causes. So what you want to say, it was kind of like a gentleman's war.
Well, when you're fighting over oysters, I guess you got to have a little perspective.
You got to be even tougher.
But I think I would recommend to everybody, regardless of what source they get, that the subject of the CSS Shenandoah and the people on board it. I've also thought the story at the end when they pulled into Liverpool,
yeah,
and most of the crew were obviously
they were from,
non-Confederate.
A lot of them were from Scotland, England. Yep. They had the brogue and the Cockney accent, and the British captain asked them, "Where are you from, sir?" "Oh, I'm from Montgomery, Alabama." With this brogue and accent, they were schooled by the Southerners on board the ships. You know, tell them you're from Montgomery, Alabama, or from, you know, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yeah, there's a certain romantic tinge to it, but I think most of them are just trying to avoid getting thrown in
right,
jail.
Right, getting put in jail, yeah.
Well, Mr. Connery, that was a very quick half hour. I appreciate you coming on this afternoon to talk with us about it. Now, obviously, next Saturday, you're going to be over at the United States Naval Memorial, but do you have some other lectures or other venues you're going to be at in the next few months?
Yeah, well, as they come, people can contact me, william.connery@verizon.net. The beginning of May, I'm going to be speaking at the Maryland encampment of Sons of Confederate Veterans, and just as things go along. And I'm also in the process, I got a contract to write my first book. Here I am, 62 years old, I'm writing my first book, which is going to be on Northern Virginia in 1861. So that's mainly what I'm concentrating on right now.
So there's hope for us 60-year-olds with book contracts are in the offing?
Yeah, of course.
Well, thank you very much, Bill. We look forward to seeing that and maybe catching you down the road. Enjoy next Saturday, and thanks a lot for your contribution to helping everybody educate about our history and some of its depth.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Yep.
And just a little reminder to everybody, you are listening to Midrats, and today's subject is on the Navy and its contribution on the Civil War. And our second guest is also going to be speaking next Saturday over at the U.S. Navy Memorial over in D.C. He is Matthew Ang. He's the Deputy Director of Education for the Hampton Roads Naval Museum. And we just had somebody in his 60s coming up, and we have someone from a different generation and a different generational view, perhaps. He's a 2006 graduate of James Madison University with a BA in history. He also has an MA in history from Old Dominion University just down the road with a focus on naval and maritime history. Most of his research has been focused on the U.S. Civil War, U.S. Navy propaganda, otherwise known as the Recruiting Command, and the role of African Americans in the United States Navy. Matthew, welcome to Midrats.
Welcome. Thank you.
Hey, it must be pretty interesting for you. You have James Madison University, just a short drive, and you also have your background at ODU, and so you find yourself there at the Hampton Roads Naval Museum, obviously because you're right there in the Fertile Corridor. If you drive from, you know, the Norfolk, Virginia Beach, Hampton Roads area up to Richmond, you cannot pull off to a Wendy's or a Stuckey's without coming in, you know, to Stonewall Jackson's Arm or some other battle when you do the Beltway. So you're right there in the center mass of much of the Civil War history. What other events are y'all going to have at the Hampton Roads Naval Museum to help, you know, educate people about what this 150th anniversary is about?
Well, I mean, obviously the biggest event really, not just in this area's history, but in Civil War history, of course, is the Battle of Hampton Roads. And that is going to be next year, March 8th and 9th, 2012. And we are slated to have a joint conference with some museums, such as the Museum of the Confederacy, the Mariners Museum, and also the National Museum of the Civil War Navy in Port Columbus, to have a joint conference, probably in Newport News, where everybody that and anybody that does Civil War scholarship involving the Navy can come down there and learn. And we just had one last year. I covered it for the Civil War Navy sesquicentennial and at the Mariners Museum, and there was a pretty good crowd there. So I think the response can be pretty good for 2012, to be able to have some people come and talk about, you know, everything, because the Navy in the Civil War, you know, wasn't just on land operations or joint cooperation with the Army, although, you know, that is important. Really, what we were just talking about in the last 30 minutes, it was technically a world war. You know, the Union Navy going around the world trying to find ships like the Shenandoah, you know, was a big concern, especially for, you know, when you're talking about legitimacy of the Confederacy and of the blockade of the Navy. So, but to get back to the, you know, this area, primarily when you think about Hampton Roads, you usually think about the engagement between the CSS Virginia and the USS Monitor. So we'll definitely be focusing on that within the next year.
I this is Eagle One. I had a chance to look at David Dixon Porter's The Naval History of the Civil War here recently, which, by the way, you can download for free off Google. But, you know, he stresses how important the blockade was and what its success was, given that they started out with kind of as most fleet commanders will always argue, the fleet they started out with was pretty weak. But one of the things he really stressed was the importance of maintaining the Potomac River and access to the sea to protect Washington and the lines of communication with the troops in Virginia. Can you talk about that a little bit? I know that's a little off the beat of Hampton Roads, but it's in that area.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, when you're talking about, I guess, the, you know, 1861, so, you know, last week, I guess April 12th, you know, Fort Sumter happens, and I think the reality is for people like Gideon Welles and later Gustavus Vassa Fox for the United States or the Union Navy, you got to think about how, you know, how many ships they actually had. You know, they only had you know, less than 100 ships that were actually in active service, and most of those you know, really weren't nothing to you know, to write home about. They had to recall, you know, all these ships from all over the world, really. So when they get back here to Norfolk, when one of the concerns within the first year of the war leading up to March 1862 was these reports of, you know, the Merrimack, which was destroyed when they burned Gospel Naval Yard right around this time. And, of course, that converts to the CSS Virginia. So you hear news reports about how this ironclad is going to come up the Potomac River and destroy Washington. And, of course, nobody had ever seen a ship like this. It, you know, it's brand new. So for, you know, their concern, it's a big deal. Plus, you know, want to take into effect that a lot of the things that were happening on the Potomac River, you know, were also the you know, similar to what would go on in the James River, where there would be, you know, naval mines that would be used for blocking. And it's, you know, just like any other land battle, the rivers were major theaters of warfare. So, you know, the distance between Richmond and Washington, D.C. is no different than channeling up the Potomac River, landing, you know, amphibious landing and taking Washington, D.C. And you got to also take in the fact that some of these guys might remember the fact that the British burned Washington, D.C. during the War of 1812. And for some of these guys, or maybe somebody as old as Winfield Scott, it was a big reality that, you know, this is a new kind of warfare, though, a civil war. So they're actually unclear about how, you know, the Confederacy or the Union would be able to engage in combat. And we see, you know, really drastically different kinds of warfare on the rivers and also at sea. But, you know, the Potomac was a whole separate squadron that very famous officers like Charles Wilkes were in command of throughout the war.
One of the interesting things from the naval perspective of the Civil War is what the Confederacy was able to do. If it wasn't, you know, for an aggressive immigrant and President Lincoln's foresight, the Monitor never would have showed up when she showed up. But when you look at the CSS Virginia, which, like you said, you know, nobody had seen this iron monster before. You look at the submarine Hunley. You look at the work that was done by the blockade runners to what we would call now, you know, trick my ride. They tried to get as much speed as they could out of it to push these paddle wheel steamers out as fast as possible. We saw some rather innovative maritime camouflage take place. And you also saw riverine warfare reach the point that in a lot of the important battles, you would have boats coming up rivers, providing fire from the onboard cannon to support, you know, really joint operations, these mobile batteries that they used. What, and again, I do come at this from a slightly partisan point of view, but it seems like the Confederacy was forced to be very inventive with little money, little resources, and really got some cutting-edge technology. Its efficacy was iffy, while at the same time, the Union forces in their riverine warfare really kind of broke some new ground. Was that unusually inventive war from a naval development point of view? Are there other occasions you can think of where innovation took place at that time?
You know, I get asked this question a lot from the Civil War Navy Sesquicentennial website. There's a link on there. If you have any questions, you can email, which goes, you know, straight to my email. And that question actually comes up a lot. And it comes up a lot from a lot of World War II enthusiasts because, as you know, in the Second World War, some of the greatest innovations are, you know, the how they were able to land Marines, at least involving with the Navy, onto those islands for the Japanese. And, you know, when I think about that and I think about what the Navy did during the Civil War, of course, me being more of a Civil War historian, I happen to think that the innovation is really unparalleled for the 19th century. There's, you know, talk of, you know, some of these guys during the Crimean War going over there when they were under the blockade of, you know, I always say this wrong, Sebastopol. I know that's probably not how you say it.
Good enough for me.
Yeah, good enough, yeah. So when they're doing that blockade there during the Crimean War, there's this guy, of course, some of my research focuses on this naval battle of Memphis in 1862, and one of those guys that goes to Russia and says, you know, I have a way to be able to break this blockade. It's a iron-braced ram, you know, no guns on it. It's very fast, you know, side-wheel steamers, and it'd be able to actually break the blockade in that area. And, you know, this was kind of laughed at not only in Russia, but also in the United States. And it wasn't until, you know, the innovation of the CSS Virginia, which, you know, having a prow in the front as well, and being able to ram the Cumberland, that people started to take notice. So, you know, there's innovations such as rams, which were used on the Mississippi River, especially in the year 1862. You also got to think about, as you mentioned earlier, you know, submarine warfare as far as the Hunley. When I think about other, you know, I guess facets of innovation, there's also, at least on the Mississippi River, there's the, you know, the Pook Turtles and James Eads, who was an engineer. And these guys were the ones that actually knew a little bit about the, you know, marine kind of lifestyle of the Mississippi River and built their vessels accordingly to be able to actually move with the free-flowing river. And actually, one of the guys who was heading up the ram fleet, Charles Ellet Jr., was a civil engineer before the war. Actually, he was in a dispute over the Wheeling Bridge in West Virginia. But he knew about and wrote papers on the how the Mississippi River basically works. So he was the one who really started that whole ram concept. But as far as other innovations, the biggest ones, at least for the Confederacy, if it wasn't the, you know, development of naval mines, and, you know, of course, block ships aren't necessarily new, you got to think about, you know, not only the, you know, things like the CSS Virginia, because it was really the first, but also the
somebody wants you on another line.
Ships like the CSS David, which was another one of these.
Hello? You there?
Yes.
I'm here.
Okay,
I'm
good.
Here. So, are you there?
Everybody there. Continue. Sorry about that.
Oh, okay. All right. But really, the for the Confederacy, like you said, these, you know, they're only weigh, you know, a couple hundred tons, blockade runners, you know, and we always see, you know, the romantic concept of blockade runners and, you know, things like Gone Like the Wind, but, you know, the reality is that blockade runners were the primary concern really for the overall grand strategy of the Union, if you think about the Navy's involvement, which was trying them trying to be able to, you know, get enough ships in there to block 3,000 miles. And the blockade runners, you know, doesn't matter which side you like to interpret or commemorate, blockade runners had a huge part in, you know, dictating really the overall aspect of the entire war, not just on land, but at sea as well. So I think blockade runners for the Confederacy were, you know, hugely important, and especially the, you know, as far as the World War that we talked about earlier, these cruisers like the Alabama and the Florida and commerce raiders had a big impact on a lot of the hearts and the minds and the morale that would go on because, you know, just for instance, the Alabama, when it was all said and done and the Kearsarge sank it, they had sunk roughly over 60 ships, 65 ships alone, roughly. And that was about $6 million in value in their money, in 1864, 1865 money. And that'd be, you know, over $100 million in today's money. That was pretty much the budget of the United States Navy in 1865. So clearly, you know, all these kind of innovations, well, you know, they played a huge impact in the war.
Well, you've spoken about the Mississippi River campaign, to me, it's one of the more interesting aspects of the Civil War because it was fought from both ends and fought slightly differently from the north to the south. But could you discuss that a little bit? I mean, the common saying is that a ship's a fool to fight a fort, but that's exactly what the fleet that came up the Mississippi to New Orleans had to do. How did they do that? What technology did they use that made it work, and what was the effect of that in the long run on how the war came out?
Well, I mean, to really give a little bit of background to it, in, of course, 1861, the war starts. Part of General Winfield Scott's Anaconda plan was not only the blockade of the southern coast, but as part of that kind of coil of the snake to go up the Mississippi River, thereby it would cut the Confederacy in two, and it would stop all the supplies. This is, of course, a new kind of warfare up the Mississippi River. What the Union Navy was trying to do, they had a base up there at Cairo, Illinois, and from that main Navy base, they would be able to move downriver, as well as use the West Gulf blockading squadron to move upriver, and hopefully to basically meet at one specific place, and of course, that place ended up being Vicksburg in 1863. What makes the Mississippi River, I think, so important for the overall war effort is, you know, the idea today of combined operations with the Army and the Navy. And really, when we talk about all the great naval leaders of the Civil War, of course, Grant's up there. And Grant was one of the ones that worked very closely with a lot of the Navy High Command in the Mississippi River to essentially use troops and use the fleet to move downriver in combined operations. And you think about, you know, Forts Henry, Fort Donelson, Island Number 10, the Battle of Memphis, which was primarily just a naval battle. But really the hallmark of it is Vicksburg and what they did, because what eventually was you know, some limited skirmishes ended up being an all-out siege by 1863, and neither Army or Navy could have done it without the aid of the other. And really, one of Grant's first great victories at Shiloh, there was also Navy involvement there. But they realized very quickly that it wouldn't be an easy fight. You know, you think about some of the more failed campaigns of the Mississippi River, the Red River campaign that Porter was under being the most shining example. I think that, though, when you think about riverine warfare, you know, in later wars like Vietnam, you have to kind of go back and look at the Civil War and say that, you know, some of the lessons were taught, you know, at a heavy price. There's reports from people like, you know, Henry Walk that used the river for warfare. He was the CO of the captain of the Carondelet, and, you know, there's a Battles and Leaders of the Civil War is something that a lot of Civil War historians use, just like the official records of the Union and Confederate navies. You know, he's talking about a little bit more what you primarily hear on land, you know, talking about the hardships that were at Gettysburg and Tietam and whatnot. You know, but he's talking about, you know, all these impressive shots from forts and having to, you know, basically sand down the decks to be able to get the blood off of it. You know, you usually don't think that the Navy is going to be involved in that hard of combat, but they really were. And some of these battles were pretty brutal. You got to think about New Orleans or the Battle of Memphis, which was almost a comical battle because it involved one Ram fleet that was commanded actually by somebody in the Confederate Army, and also the Charles Ellet, which I mentioned earlier. And basically it's a group of eight Rams going against two Rams, and they're going 12 knots upriver, downriver, and running into each other. It must have been kind of funny to see that in 1862. And what's even more, I guess, not comical, but more poignant to the time period is that just like in things like Bull Run, there were close to, over 10,000 civilians from the city of Memphis that sat there and watched this thing unfold before their eyes. So I think that there's a huge need to be able to understand that, the war, especially for the River War, was, vital to the effort. There's a historian and author, James Merrill, who actually was the one who switched me on from in college, switching from the land aspect of the Civil War to the river one, and also really the Navy in general, where he basically said, the war is essentially over in 1863, mostly because of the contributions of, all the gunboats and the rams and the ironclads down the Mississippi. It's a fantastic book. It's my favorite Civil War book, and will probably always will be. But it was a brutal affair. I think between 2,000 and 3,000 sailors died during the Civil War, about 5% of all the fighting forces in general. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't commemorate them and really incorporate the Navy into this overall grand strategy, both of the Union and of the Confederate Navy. And that's really what we're trying to do for the Civil War Navy sesquicentennial.
Yeah, I almost brought up, I was glad that you mentioned the Battle of Shiloh. I've had the opportunity to walk the battlefield, which is, one thing this country has done a pretty good job at is preserving our battlefields, because until you walk it, you really can't get a feel for it. But where the gunboats came into play, and I know the Vicksburg campaign very well, because that's how all my family stuff got burned to the ground during Grant's hook around to the South. But there's so much to learn there about our history and about our people. And one thing I wanted to touch on is an area of your expertise is African Americans in the Navy. And when you see a lot of the old pictures on Navy ships and the Civil War, you'll see there are a couple of African Americans in the background here and there, generally blended into the crew. Most people, when they think about the Navy and African Americans, they think of highly segregated. You had our one destroyer escort that was mostly African American, and we had as a guest on last year Lanier Phillips, who was a survivor of a shipwreck in World War II, U.S. Navy. He was a steward there. He came in and broke the color barrier in the 1950s as the first sonar tech that was African American, and really kind of helped break the color lines in a lot of areas. What were the rules and regulations in the U.S. Navy during the Civil War concerning blacks? Were they integrated? Were they only allowed to work in certain areas? Or did they build upon the merchant model that you would see a lot of that era?
Well, as a preface, the Navy for, a military institution was for the most part colorblind. The role of African Americans in the Navy goes all the way back to the Revolutionary War, where they served as, knowledgeable pilots. If you know about Robert Smalls, he was one of the more famous ones that escaped the blockade at Charleston into safety of the Union. But as far as the role of African Americans in the Navy in the Civil War, right after, the Confederates fired at Fort Sumter, you have a large number of African Americans either enlisting up north, free blacks, or what's more interesting, I think, is the idea of what I call the contraband question, which in spring 1862, Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles had becoming more and more aware that there were alarming numbers of people that were African American slaves that were literally jumping in the water and swimming to some of these ships on the blockades. And, you know, people like DuPont and all the commanders that were operating in the South Atlantic Blockade Squadron are writing to Gideon Welles and basically saying, you know, I don't know what to do. There's a really famous quote from Port Royal that Charles Francis Adams Jr. wrote. He said, you know, there were 7,000 masterless slaves within the line, and in less than 2 months he thinks there's going to be 70,000. And this is in 1862. So what eventually happened in December, Gideon Welles approved the enlistment of slaves as landsmen, which were essentially unskilled sailors with no naval experience. What's important about that, though, is that African Americans could be able to, you know, earn rank, would be able to, you know, earn pay, and most importantly for, you know, African American history today, that they were able to fight for their freedom, because, you know, the role of African Americans, when you think about the Civil War, most people will go to something like in the movie Glory with the 54th Massachusetts. That was a, you know, for the most part, you know, a segregated unit, or they might think about the Fort Pillow Massacre. But for the United States Navy, they were completely integrated and colorblind. African Americans were, oops, sorry, go ahead.
No, I said, and that's what fascinates me about that story. And if Eagle wanted to let me steal a little bit of his time here, we have that data point of an integrated Navy during the Civil War, but then it takes another 80 years before that starts to creep out again. When after the war do we see that one Navy, one team break back into a segregated model?
Probably after Plessy versus Ferguson. That's 1896, I believe. You know, when that became, segregation became the kind of the unspoken law of the land, you know, Jim Crow takes over. That really was the case for the Navy as well. If you look at the, you know, the documents, there's, by the time the 19th century rolls into the 20th century, African Americans are relegated to two positions. They could be a messman or a steward. And, you know, I do a lot of programs on African American history and diversity of the Navy down here at the Hampton Roads Naval Museum. And one of the, you know, one of the things I talk about when I begin with is the fact that there's two, you know, bright shining lights for African Americans in the Navy until, you know, 1948 when they desegregate. One is the Civil War and the other one's World War II. So, you know, things kind of quiet down for African Americans where, you know, they're stopping enlistment and whatnot after the Civil War, and it doesn't really pick back up. And they're given a chance to truly show, you know, the honor, courage, and commitment that we all talk about today until World War II. Because, you know, like you mentioned earlier, you know, USS Mason, highly successful. You know, there's a sub chaser as well that had a African American crew on it, and you know that people started to take notice of that. And you know, unfortunately, it wasn't until 1948 that they make it official. Truman desegregates the armed forces. But the stepping stones, though, for African Americans started, or really truly started, during the Civil War for the Navy.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the more interesting things to me is that we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War and the 100th anniversary of naval aviation. One of the other intriguing developments during the Civil War was the use of ship-mounted balloons for observation. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I really don't know too much about it. I know for a fact that we have one of these ships, the GWP Custis, in our museum, and basically it's a means of reconnaissance. And it's usually when we talk about naval aviation, we usually start with Eugene Ely in 1910. You know, these ships did play a I wouldn't say a significant role, but played a role in kind of kickstarting the idea of naval aviation. For the most part, the Navy would recognize Eugene Ely as kind of the start, but they did play a role, especially here in this area, as it is in our is in our museum.
Well, we're coming up here with about 1 minute left, Matthew. You just like I did before with Bill, if you're going to be involved next Saturday over at the Navy Memorial, but obviously You're there full-time at the Hampton Roads Naval Museum. Are there other venues that you're going to be at as we're going through the sesquicentennial, if people wanted to go and listen to some more things you would like to talk about on the subject?
Well, it's I mean, basically what I was saying earlier, it's, you know, if people want to contact me for, you know, Speakers Bureau type engagements, they certainly can. I'm actually speaking of naval aviation down here in Chesapeake, Virginia on the 28th. That's involving naval aviation, so it's not necessarily involved with the Civil War. The next thing besides the 23rd April event, where I'm talking about the Civil War, Navy, and public memory, we're probably going to start a bunch of public programs here in the summer where we'll be able to get out there and there are Civil War gallery at the Naval Museum and really engage some of the guests and you know, show them a lot about what we have. We have, you know, all the CSS Florida artifacts. There's a new exhibit we'll be launching here pretty soon, or at least the official opening of it coming up, and that's an underwater archaeology exhibit. And also, we are the main repository of artifacts, soul of the USS Cumberland. So definitely come on down and, you know, or send an email or go to the Civil War Navy Sesquicentennial blog and definitely get involved, because we're very interested in how the public is into this idea of Civil War memory and its involvement with the Navy.
Absolutely, and hopefully you'll have some active duty folks who will give y'all a call and bring some of their sailors by, because unfortunately, as you know, our public school systems really don't do an adequate job of telling a fascinating story that really highlights America at its best and at its areas that could use improvement. Matthew, thank you very much for taking some time this afternoon to come along and join us at MidRats, and good luck next Saturday, and hope things work out well for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Matthew. Enjoyed it.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us live, and I hope you have a great Navy Day.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly.
I'm looking at this enormous burrito, and man, it's big, I tell you that. Dang. Give me one of them enormouses. Enormouses. Watch out. Let's do it now.
Okay, I think I know what you're ordering.
Get the new Eggnormous Burrito now only at Burger King. A hearty breakfast burrito packed with sausage and bacon, plus eggs, cheese, and hash browns. Only at Burger King at participating restaurants.
Good morning. Welcome to Burger King.
I'm looking at this enormous burrito, and man, it's big, I tell you that. Dang. Give me one of them enormouses. Enormouses. Watch out. Let's do it now.
Okay, I think I know what you're ordering.
Get the new Eggnormous Burrito now only at Burger King. A hearty breakfast burrito packed with sausage and bacon, plus eggs, cheese, and hash browns. Only at Burger King at participating restaurants.